treatment centers and looks closely at the risks they pose to communities where they are located. Evidence points to detention centers sparking infections early in the pandemic and making outbreaks worse, the report says. The multi-county area surrounding detention centers with the highest number of people detained saw a 20% increase in COVID-19 caseloads. Hooks, the report co-author, said, "I think of prisons and detention centers as ongoing super spreader of events."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Iran calls on the UN to condemn the terror attack on its top nuclear scientist, and the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Yemen's health ministry says thousands of newborn babies die every year due to Saudi Arabia's blockade and aggression. Also ahead, the Netherlands announces a ban on passenger flights from the UK after British officials said a new coronavirus strain has surfaced in the country. Welcome to the program. Iran's ambassador to the UN has called on the world body to condemn the assassination of high-profile Iranian military and scientific figures. Majid Takht-e-Ravanchi dismissed as blatant terrorist crimes the assassinations of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He said these crimes must be condemned straightforwardly and without reservation. Elsewhere in his remarks, the senior diplomat underlined that Tehran should be able to reap the economic benefits of the 2015 nuclear deal. He said the Europeans had vowed to guarantee the continuation of economic relations with Tehran envisaged in the nuclear agreement. He further noted that Europe's mechanism to facilitate trade transactions, known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, should prove its efficiency. Yemen's health ministry says thousands of newborn babies die every year due to Saudi Arabia's blockade and aggression. According to the ministry, six Yemeni children die every 2 hours. It said hospitals in the war-torn country are understaffed and unequipped. It slammed Riyadh and its allies for preventing the entry of medical equipment and medicine. Saudi Arabia launched an all-out war on its southern neighbor in March of 2015 and has since imposed a crippling siege on the impoverished nation. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives as a result. Political commentator Ken Stone says the main objective of the Saudi war on Yemen is for the U.S. to regain its hegemony in the region.
The mainstream media in the West is in the pockets of the U.S. empire and the corporations, the big military-industrial complex that runs the U.S. and most of the countries in the West. And they don't print anything that doesn't suit the interests of the rich and powerful who are waging this war. And they're waging this war for a reason. And the reason is that the United States wants Saudi Arabia to help it regain hegemony over the oil-rich and strategic Middle East. And this is at the root of the problem, whether it's Biden or whether it's Trump, the end goal remains the same, U.S. hegemony in the Middle East. I have no level of optimism concerning Mr. Biden. As I said, he was vice president when the U.S. gave Saudi Arabia the green light to start this war in 2015. Yep. The U.S. under Trump sold hundreds of millions of dollars of arms to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE. And Biden's strategic aims are the same as Trump's, and haven't changed since 2015, and that is a hegemonic agenda for the U.S. The empire wants to regain what it lost in 1979.
Children and women in Yemen continue to suffer from health insecurity amid the ongoing war and blockade in the country. A pair of newborn conjoined twins in the war-ravaged Yemen are now in immediate need of treatment abroad due to the lack of resources in their own country.
In a rare case, the second in Yemen in the past 3 years, a pair of conjoined twins were born in a Sabain hospital in Yemeni capital Sana'a. The two children are in critical condition and need to be treated outside the country, which is impossible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a airport to the Yemenis.
This is a tragedy that children in Yemen suffer as a result of aggression, blockade, and the use of internationally prohibited weapons as well as malnutrition. In the case of the Siamese twins and congenital deformations, the biggest problem is that we cannot send them abroad to have surgery, so their lives are at risk.
The director of the Health Bureau called on the United Nations and the World Health Organization to send a plane to transport the two children or to send a medical team to conduct the surgery inside Yemen, where devastated and under-resourced health services cannot offer any help to these children.
I'm the father of the twins, and their condition is critical, and they need to receive medical care and surgery outside the country because the health situation in Yemen is collapsing and Sana'a airport is still closed.
Infants suffer a difficult situation in Yemen, and the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemen health services have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on the country in 2015.
With the fast approaching of the new year, the Sana'a airport remains closed to sick children and women, causing the loss of many lives. The airport is open to United Nations airplanes only. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad says the West must protect, or correct, I should say, its deadly approach in the world. Miqdad made the remark in an interview in Moscow at the end of his official visit to Russia. He said the unilateral coercive measures taken against Syria are inhumane and can be classified as war crimes and crimes against humanity. Miqdad called on the U.S. not to look for its interests through inhumane methods that are considered a violation of international law. He stressed that the administration of the outgoing U.S. President Trump has caused worldwide destruction. Political commentator Bijan Tavassoli says the effects of U.S. sanctions on Syria are the same as the effects of war crimes.
First of all, I don't think that the focus should be on the question whether, from a formal judicial point of view, it has to be qualified as war crimes. The question to me is more whether the effect of the U.S. sanctions on Syria and other countries, whether the effects are the same as those of war crimes. And I think that question can definitively be answered with a clear yes. Because whether you kill babies and mothers with a bomb or with sanctions, it should not matter so much. And these sanctions are not targeted at military institutions. No, they target the civilian population. And so from that point of view, they kill innocent people every day. And I think it's correct to compare them to war crimes, because what else is it when you kill innocent people who have nothing to do with any armed conflict?
Former chief of Australia's military has blamed the country's top brass for alleged war crimes in Afghanistan. Admiral Chris Berry says Australia's military leadership is responsible for any crimes committed by Aussie troops in Afghanistan. Berry has called for a royal commission to probe the allegations. A four-year investigation found evidence that Australian Special Forces committed dozens of unlawful killings in Afghanistan. The inquiry recommended prosecution for 19 current and former soldiers for suspected war crimes between the years 2005 and 2016, but it determined that responsibility does not extend to higher officials. The Netherlands has banned passenger flights from the UK from Sunday after British officials said they have detected a new coronavirus strain in the country. A travel ban will remain in place until January the 1st. The Dutch government says it is considering additional measures regarding other means of transportation from the UK. It has already warned citizens to avoid non-essential trips. British scientists have warned that a new strain identified in the country is up to 70% more infectious. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced tough restrictions for London and southeast England to prevent the spread of the new strain. The COVID-19 outbreak in Europe shows no signs of abating as several countries impose new restrictions to curb the spread of the virus. France reported more than 17,000 new cases, pushing its total tally to nearly 2.5 million. The country has introduced nighttime curfews and delayed the reopening of culture venues to curb the spread. Italy reported over 16,000 new infections and more than 550 deaths. Italy has announced strict restrictions between Christmas Eve and January the 6th. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has imposed a lockdown effective immediately on almost 18 million people and reversed plans to ease curbs over Christmas.
First, we will introduce new restrictions in the most affected areas, specifically those parts of London, the South East and the East of England, which are currently in Tier 3. These areas will enter a new Tier 4, which will be broadly equivalent to the national restrictions which were in place in England in November. That means residents in those areas must stay at home, apart from limited exemptions set out in law. Non-essential retail, indoor gyms and leisure facilities and personal care services must close. People must work from home if they can, but may travel to work if this is not possible, for example, in the construction and manufacturing sectors.
Measures came after the British government said it is dealing with a new coronavirus strain that is up to 70% more transmissible than the original. Number of cases in England has soared in the last 2 weeks because of the virus variant. In Russia, COVID-19 deaths surpassed 50,000. The country also recorded over 28,000 new cases on Saturday. American biotechnology company Moderna has received the approval of U.S. health agencies to distribute its coronavirus vaccines in an effort to curb the pandemic. A panel of the U.S. Centers for Disease and Disease Control and Prevention voted to recommend the use of the vaccine on people 18 years of age and older. The Food and Drug Administration has already authorized the emergency use of the vaccine. Moderna is the second company to get the approval for its anti-coronavirus vaccine in the U.S. after Pfizer. The distribution of Moderna began Saturday, with thousands of sites due to start receiving and administering shots as soon as Monday. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit country, having reported more than 17.6 million infections, and over 316,000 deaths. Meanwhile, South Korea has reported a record number of new daily coronavirus infections since the pandemic began. The country registered as many as 1,097 cases on Sunday, bringing the total infections to nearly 50,000. The new cases included an outbreak in a Seoul prison that infected 185, in fact. The overall COVID-19 deaths in the country hovers around 700. Sunday was the fifth consecutive day that South Korea reported daily infections of over 1,000. Some medical experts have criticized the government as being slow to introduce tighter social distancing rules. A recent surge has heightened concerns as the country runs short of hospital beds. U.S. media say the Trump administration is planning to shut down two remaining consulates in Russia. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that matter with our guests.
Hello, welcome to the news review. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is planning to shut down two remaining consulates in Russia. A copy of notification obtained by U.S. media show that the State Department had informed Congress of this decision last week. The closure of the missions in the two areas would leave the U.S. with only its embassy in Moscow. The notice had cited caps placed by Russian authorities in 2017 on the number of American diplomats in the country as the reason. However, the move comes at a time of heightened tensions between the two nations amid the recent revelation of a massive cyber attack against numerous U.S. government departments and agencies. On Friday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Russia was, quote, pretty clearly behind the cyber attacks. Moscow, however, has denied any involvement. Maria Kartanova is our correspondent joining us from Moscow. Greg Simmons is an author and a researcher who joins us from Uppsala. Marina, first over to you. Tell us about the closures. Tell us if there's been any official reaction from the Russian government.
Well, the decision of the State Department to close the last two U.S. Consulates in Russia is related to the optimization of the work of the American diplomatic mission. The consulate in Vladivostok was temporarily closed in March due to the coronavirus pandemic. In Yekaterinburg, it continued to work. Yekaterinburg is our Ural capital, but on a limited basis. If closed, the only U.S. diplomatic center in Russia will be the embassy in Moscow. So the U.S. decision to close the two consulates in Yekaterinburg and the Vladivostok, they are related and they are not related to coronavirus pandemic and the epidemiological situation in Russia. This is how the U.S. Embassy in Russia commented this decision. They said that the State Department's decision on consulates was made to optimize the work, as I mentioned before, to optimize the work of American mission in Russia. And despite the fact that the decision is not related to coronavirus pandemic, the ongoing health crisis may affect the timetable for implementing the decision. So no actions is planned with respect to Russian diplomatic institutions in the United States. But 5 days ago earlier, Vladimir Putin, the press secretary, Dmitry Peskov, said that the closure of U.S. Consulates in the Russian Federation will not spoil relations between the two countries, even more. He said consular and visa services have not been provided for a long time in these American overseas institutions on our territory. The main function of consulates is to provide consular and visa services, and these consular and visa services have not been carried out for a long time in these American overseas missions in Russia. So, as he said, there is no particular influence. Since March, the American consulate in Yekaterinburg has been providing only services related to emergency situations. And the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and the U.S. consular agency in Sakhalin operate in the same way, actually.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Greg Simmons. All right, let's look at the analytical side of things here. Of course, you have the closures taking place, as announced by the U.S., but then again, the news indicates that this is either a coincidence or not with what some have called the Pearl Harbor of the U.S. regarding the cyber attacks, which Mike Pompeo has said, the Secretary of State on his way out, said that, well, it's pretty clear that Russia is behind it. Do you think it's a coincidence or not? And, of course, your reaction to the two closures.
I think the decision was probably made before this Russia did it yet again. Accusation. So this has probably been in the process for some time. And this is interesting because what it indicates or implies at least, is that Donald Trump has got pulled into this whole Russia conspiracy theory and this kind of anti-Russian hysteria, this Russia Gate, as it is popularly called there. And what would probably happen is that there will be a demand for Russia to close two consulates in the US. Now, the effect of the closure, of course, is going to reduce the capacity and effectiveness of American public diplomacy in the Russian Federation beyond Moscow. Because, for instance, the consulate in Yekaterinburg runs a lot of cultural programs and the like. And so this is a point where the US is trying to create some soft power and influence beyond Moscow. So this will be gone. I mean, the fact that this cyber attack happened, it's something else. And of course, they're playing the same game. There is no proof this quickly who did it. And I mean, these cyber attacks, you would think that the US never engaged in cyber attacks against anyone else. I mean, if we go back that far, not too long ago, of course, the US is very active in these cyber attacks.
Thank you very much for that. Greg Simmons, author and researcher, and Marina Kortsinova, our correspondent from Moscow. Thank you so much. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response, Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Birthday of the heroine of Karbala. In the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest felicitations to you on a very auspicious occasion. We are celebrating the birthday of the immortal heroine of Karbala, and we invite you to join us in listening to a special feature on this blessed day. Stay with us, please. Today, the 5th of the Islamic month of Jamadi al-Awwal is celebrated in the Islamic Republic of Iran as the Day of the Nurse, to honor the services to humanity of these paramedics who strive day and night to ensure the recovery of patients suffering from various diseases. These days, when we in Iran and the whole world are in the grip of the coronavirus pandemic, the selfless services of the nursing staff, whether male or female, have assumed added importance, especially after the sacrifices they have offered for the recovery of patients, with many of them attaining martyrdom in the process. The point, however, is, what is the significance of this particular date of the year for nurses? It is a good question, and the answer is obvious. For your information, today is that auspicious day in history when the virtuous lady that nursed Islam back to life was born. She was none other the heroine of Karbala, Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, the granddaughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It is beyond the power of ordinary mortals to pen the merits and virtues of Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, whose praise requires a tongue as eloquent as that of the Noble Quran, or as heart-soothing as that of the Prophet of Islam, as expressive as that of her father, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, as fluent as that of her brother, the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and as steeped in piety as that of her nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him. Her genealogy is impeccable. She was a blue-blood scion of monotheist House of Hisham, the noble leader of the Quraysh tribe, who was descended from Prophet Abraham's firstborn son, Prophet Ishmael, peace be upon them. If her father, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, continues to transcend history and historical developments as the divinely designated vicegerent of the Almighty's last and greatest prophet, her mother is the noblest ever lady born on planet Earth, the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. If the Prophet of Islam, as the mercy unto the whole creation, is her maternal grandfather, her paternal grandfather is that protector of infant Islam, the Prophet's beloved uncle and guardian, Abu Talib, the consanguineous brother of the Prophet's father, Abdullah. If her maternal grandmother is the Ummul Mu'mineen, or mother of all true believers, Hazrat Khadijatul Kubra, peace be upon her, also known as Malikatul Arab, for her fabulous wealth that she all spent for Islam, her paternal grandmother is Fatima bint Asad, the lady who had brought up the orphaned Prophet as her own son following the death of his grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, and his mother, Amina bint Wahab. The merits of Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, who gave her two youthful sons, Aun and Muhammad, as sacrifices for the cause of Islam at Karbala, do not end here, in view of the fact that her brothers were Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them, the leaders of the youth of paradise. Moreover, she was married to her first cousin Abdullah, the son of Ja'far Tayyar, the first migrant in Islam, whose famous expounding of monotheism and the merits of Prophet Jesus and the Virgin Mary, peace upon them, in the court of King Neges of Abyssinia, Ethiopia, when the polytheist of Mecca pursued him there, is recorded in golden letters. Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, was too great to rest on family laurels. She explored a distinctive path of her own, and that is the reason her virtues merited the title Thaniyeh Zahra, or the lady who is second only to her impeccable mother, Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, the greatest lady of all times. Her mother needed an immaculate deputy to demonstrate to the women of the world the greatness of Islam and the practical meaning of piety, virtue, and feminine rights. That is why her elder daughter, Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, rose to the occasion to carve out an immortal niche for herself in history. Although not infallible like the prophets, the imams, and her own mother, the heroine of Karbala set a lasting example of flawlessness that not even the infallible Adam could match because of his slight negligence in approaching the forbidden tree while in heaven at the dawn of human creation. Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, was the embodiment of practical knowledge. The Iranian scholar Sheikh Sadugh, who flourished over 1,000 years ago, writes, "People used to refer to her in jurisprudential matters related to the sanctioned and forbidden until her nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, recovered from his illness." In view of this statement, it is knowledge that unravels all realities. In other words, there is no aspect of human life that does not require knowledge and awareness. Her father, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, in his famous advice to his disciple, Kumail ibn Ziyad, as mentioned in Nahjul Balagha, has beautifully outlined the indispensable nature of knowledge as more worthy than wealth, saying, "Knowledge guards you while you have to guard wealth. Wealth decreases by spending, while knowledge increases by spending." In Islam, the pursuit of knowledge is not confined to men, but women are also urged to acquire it. Unlike other creeds and cultures, Islam restored women to her natural status in society with emphasis on learning so that literate and knowledgeable mothers could properly groom their children, the future hope of the society. Thus, Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, was immune from any ignorance and possessed God-given knowledge with certitude. No less a personality than her nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, says about her, "You are, by the grace of God, a scholar unschooled by anyone and a sage by connation." The fourth Imam, in praise of her eloquent sermons in Kufa and Damascus, when in the aftermath of the heartrending tragedy of Karbala, the noble prisoners were brought before the Umayyad rulers, has spoken about the realities and finer points of her God-given intelligence and knowledge. He said that what his impeccable aunt demonstrated is not easy to grasp by even the most erudite scholars. Her clarity of language and choice of words to expound the mission of her brother in the court of the tyrant Yazid is rather unique. History is incapable of doing full justice to her sermons that ensured eternity for the mission of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Scholars, pointing to a single phrase from her memorable sermon in the court of Damascus, say that besides being an indicator of her firm faith, trust in God, sincerity of purpose, and dauntlessness under the most adverse circumstances, it shattered to pieces the power and pride of tyrant Yazid. Her bold address to the seemingly proud caliph, "It is justice, O son of freed slaves," shook the very foundations of Umayyad rule and exposed its illegitimacy not only for those present at the court, including the Byzantine ambassador, but for all generations to come. By her use of the word tulaqa, that is the plural form of taliq or freed slave, Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, was actually reminding the ruler how her grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny on the day of the peaceful surrender of Mecca to Muslims in 8 AH, had shown magnanimity to the infidel Abu Sufyan, his accursed wife Hind, and his equally criminal son Muawiyah, the grandfather, grandmother, and father of Yazid, despite the fact that Hind had so savagely carved out the liver of the Prophet's martyred uncle Hamza years earlier at the Battle of Uhud and tried to chew it. On the day of the liberation of Mecca, the Prophet of Islam, magnanimous as ever, had called Abu Sufyan, Muawiyah, and their other idolatrous kinsmen, tulaqa, or freed slaves, and had spared their lives by accepting their lip service to Islam in order to teach humanity a lasting reason that what evil such despised ingrates do when opportunity comes their way to strike at the humanitarian principles that they had always opposed. Thus, it is said, the immortal saga of Karbala would have remained incomplete if not for endeavors of Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, whose birthday we celebrate today, and who nursed back to life Islam and all humanitarian values.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
First suspended, now reinstated, but without the whip. Jeremy Corbyn has been at the center of an anti-Semitism smear campaign that has plagued the Labour Party. How did this begin and what led to the suspension of the former Labour leader? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission is the UK's watchdog on racism. After years of allegations that the Labour Party was becoming a hotbed of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn, in May 2019, the EHRC launched an inquiry. Last month, it published its findings in a report. In the report, the EHRC accuses Labour leadership of political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints, and harassment of those who complained. In a report that is 130 pages long, the EHRC found two cases of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Now, granted, that's two cases too many. Anti-Semitism is wrong. Racism is wrong. Nonetheless, this doesn't match the description that we've been hearing from the British media and political establishment for the last couple of years, that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite or that he fostered a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. and that this was widespread. Those are two completely different things. And when Jeremy Corbyn pointed this out, the day of the report's release, he was suspended.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party.
To talk more, I'm joined by Israeli-American author and activist Miko Pelid. Hi, Miko. Thanks for coming on. It's good to have you.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Miko, can I just get your initial thoughts and reaction on Jeremy Corbyn being suspended and his statement that the problem of anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons? Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Well, I think the accusations of anti-Semitism were all completely and utterly false. They had nothing to do. The attacks against him, which I believe has been in place for at least till since 2016, and against all of the people that supported him in the party, in other words, his entire support network, had nothing to do with anti-Semitism or racism. He and all of his supporters do not have a racist bone or an anti-Semitic cell in their bodies. This was a politically motivated witch hunt against anybody who might stand up for the rights of Palestinians, anyone who has progressive views on the issue, anyone who dares to criticize Israel or threaten Israel in any way, shape, or form. And the idea that an activist like him, a man of conscience like him, would occupy Downing Street 10 was, you know, the Zionists' worst nightmare, and they were not going to allow it to happen.
If we look at the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, their working definition of anti-Semitism formed the backbone of the EHRC, and this definition was also adopted by the Labour Party in 2018. Now, underneath the definition, there's a few examples of what they consider to be anti-Semitism. I quote here, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Miko, you were born in Israel. You come from a very important Israeli family. You're Jewish, and you're a very staunch critic of Zionism, of Israel. And you've also said that Zionism is racism. So, I mean, does that mean you're anti-Semitic now, according to their definition?
Yes. Absolutely. But I think it's important to clarify, Zionism is not an expression of Jewish self-determination. Zionism is an expression of Zionist self-determination and the self-determination of Israelis, not of Jews. And so what they've done is they framed it in a way that to defend themselves and also to gag anybody who would dare, who would even think to criticize Israel with this definition. So now if you tell the truth, which is that the State of Israel has no legitimacy and is founded on a racist ideology, you're automatically anti-Semitic. But both of these claims are true whether they call you anti-Semitic or not. But yes, definitely, according to their definition, I am, and many of my people I respect, and certainly Jeremy Corbyn, and others, and all the Palestinians, by the way, every single Palestinian is also anti-Semitic.
So, Miko, we know that the neoliberals in the party, the Blairites, have tried very hard to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. However, how extensive would you describe the role of the Zionist lobby in getting Jeremy Corbyn suspended? Because, you know, a lot of people know what AIPAC is in the U.S., for example, but I don't think they really understand that Israel also plays a political role in the United Kingdom.
Well, there are AIPAC equivalents in every single country in Europe. And obviously, Britain is a very, very crucially important country. And so there are the same kind of Zionist agents working there as there are in the United States. You have what they call the Board of Deputies of British Jews. You've got different Zionist groups within the different parties, the Labour Party and excuse me, and so on. So they work and they actually work very closely with the Israeli embassy. in order. Right. And there's no question that as soon as it was clear that Jeremy Corbyn was going to lead the Labour Party, they were going to do everything they possibly could to make sure he would not enter Downing Street 10. And the New Liberals, the Blairites, of course, were great allies. And they were happy to work together. There's no question about that.
Ayelet Namias Verben, she's a member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. And just after Corbyn was suspended, there's a video of her boasting, essentially, that she played a role. She was a piece of the puzzle, as she says, in getting him suspended. What's your reaction to that video? What did you make of that?
It's not surprising, because this is well known. I mean, Israel did everything they possibly can, and they're proud of their so-called accomplishment. They see this as an accomplishment. The bringing down of a man who his entire life, who dedicated his entire life to fight racism and fight injustice, is what they take pride in, because the state of Israel represents racism and injustice. And so what is absurd here, that people who represent the state of Israel or different aspects within the Israeli political spectrum, who are racists, who are engaged in a racist, in operating and maintaining a racist state, who are engaged in what can only be described as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, are accusing Jeremy Corbyn, who spent his whole life fighting these things, as racist and anti-Semitic. And what is very, very, very worrisome is that they succeeded. They succeeded in a very big way, and the rest of the world is watching this and just nodding instead of standing up and saying, are you out of your minds? This is absurd.
Miko, how do you feel that this political witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn fits into the larger scheme of actually fighting anti-Semitism globally?
Well, look, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. I mean, if somebody's an anti-Semitic, they're probably racist against everybody else too. Racism is racism. And so I think what's important is to fight racism and to promote tolerance everywhere, which of course this is why Israel is not, as they some people claim, the response to the Holocaust. Number one, most Jewish people who survived the Holocaust did not go to Israel. And number two, another racist regime is never a response to a racist regime somewhere else. What we need is more tolerance. What we need is to fight racism. What we feel is to fight bigotry and to fight and to resist violence and so forth. So, you know, fighting racism is important everywhere. It's a problem everywhere. Racism, anti-Semitism, all forms of racism are problematic, and they all need to be fought with the same vigor, with the same kind of passion that Jeremy Corbyn actually displayed his entire life, and the people around him that were also brought down displayed their entire life. So if people really care about anti-Semitism, Jeremy Corbyn is their man.
Thanks very much for coming on, Miko. Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Jeremy Corbyn has made it extremely clear on many occasions that he opposes anti-Semitism and that it has no place in the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn is someone who's fought against racism his entire life. He's known for that, both in the UK and outside, internationally. This is a guy who has fought against racism in all forms, against anti-Semitism. He's championed the rights of workers. He's an anti-imperialist. He's an anti-war voice, an advocate for peace. Despite this, despite Jeremy Corbyn's unimpeachable record, the British media, the British political establishment, and the Zionist lobby have spent the last couple of years attacking him relentlessly and trying to smear him as either an anti-Semite himself or someone who enabled a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, I myself have criticized his handling of the issue, but to call the man a racist or that he is someone who enables racism is utterly absurd and ridiculous. What this all comes down to is the neoliberal establishment, the British media, the Zionists, will be trying to get rid of pro-Palestinian voices, trying to get rid of and purge the actual left within the Labour Party.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Anti-Semitism is a serious issue, and it should be opposed by the Labour Party. Fighting against racism is a fundamentally leftist value. And that's why we shouldn't confuse anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which is unfortunately what the media, what Keir Starmer, the now Labour leader, is doing. Keir Starmer himself has said that he is a Zionist without qualification. This man is a clear supporter of the Israeli apartheid state, and the last couple of years we've seen not just Corbyn but other voices championing the rights of Palestinians being purged, being kicked out of the party, being reprimanded, being suspended. There's a clear drive here to get rid of people who stand up to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by the Israeli occupation. Chris Williamson, who's also a former Labour MP and a close friend of Jeremy Corbyn, was also unfairly suspended from the Labour Party. Chris is a staunch anti-imperialist, he's a real leftist, and he's fought against racism his entire life as well. I'm joined by him now. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. It's a real honor. Thank you. I mean, I'm a big admirer of your work.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Chris, can I just get your initial thoughts on the EHRC report and Jeremy being suspended?
Well, I mean, the EHRC is a discredited organization. It's a partisan organization. It's been accused of institutional racism. It doesn't have any black or Muslim commissioners on its board. And indeed, two of the black and Muslim commissioners that it did have on the board were removed because they were deemed to be too loud and vocal about issues of race. They're very close to the Conservative Party, had a strong relationship as well with the New Labour, former New Labour government, New Labour regime, and they've come forward with a partisan report. I mean, I think the conclusions were written before the report had actually really, you know, seen the light of day, frankly. At the end of the day, they were trying to make the assertion that the Labour Party had a massive problem with anti-Semitism, but it was institutionally anti-Semitic. They didn't make that finding about institutional anti-Semitism, but they did actually argue that Labour was guilty of unlawful conduct and harassing the Jewish community based on two cases, two questionable cases, it's got to be said. They had six people initially in the initial report, six. And as a result of the legal representations that I made, they removed my name and three others. And they were left then with two people. And the way the corporate media has covered this, as if this is some terrible, shaming revelation about institutional anti-Semitism inside the Labour Party, when it's anything but. I mean, even if you accept at face value, two people out of a membership of 500,000 hardly constitutes a major problem for the Labour Party.
I wanted to ask you more about how you litigated and got your name removed from the report. Can you tell us more about that?
Basically, we threatened them that if they didn't remove my name, that I would take further legal action against them in the High Court to restrain them from publishing the report, and wouldn't be satisfied with anything short of my complete removal from the report, because I was anything but what they were accusing me of doing. I've spent my life fighting racism going back to the 1970s, actually putting my personal safety at risk, confronting fascists on the street in the 1970s, and indeed on building sites when I was a young apprentice bricklayer, when casual racism was quite a thing in the 1970s in the UK. And I would regularly challenge the casual racism that I heard at that time on building sites, and, you know, nearly got beaten up on more than a few occasions. So, you know, I'm not going to take any lectures from people who are bad faith actors and attempting to try and, you know, smear somebody, you know, with my record. And indeed, somebody with Jeremy Corbyn's record, which is an unimpeachable anti-racist record, and yet he's being demonised in the way in which he's being. It's absolutely outrageous.
It really cannot be overstated how much the British media hate Jeremy Corbyn and have relentlessly attacked and smeared him during the last couple of years. I mean, to begin with, the vast majority of printed media in the United Kingdom is right-wing, okay? But even liberal left publications like The Guardian led the charge against Corbyn and smeared him relentlessly, and still are. Not even Ed Miliband or Gordon Brown or Tony Blair, the war criminal who destroyed Iraq, who has the blood of a million Iraqis on his hands, was smeared to this level by any of the mainstream media in the UK. Think of that. Think about how Bernie Sanders is smeared in the United States, except 100 times worse. Okay, Jeremy Corbyn has been called anything you can imagine. He's been called a jihadist sympathizer. He's been called a terrorist. He's been accused of wanting to abolish the monarchy and the army. He's been accused of a million things under the sun. So the mainstream media were not just complicit, they were more than happy to participate in this targeted smear campaign against leftists in the Labour Party, and specifically Jeremy Corbyn. It's not just conjecture, it's not just speculation or me saying that. This is actually backed up by raw data. A report by The Independent found that 75% of media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn was negative and factually misrepresented him. That is astonishing for anyone to objectively say that Jeremy Corbyn has not been the target of a smear campaign by the Zionist lobby, by the political establishment in the UK, by the British media themselves, is utterly delusional and dishonest. But frankly speaking, these attacks don't just come from the Zionist lobby or from the British media. They also come from within the Labour Party itself. Even though Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership contest in 2015 by attracting a lot of new members to the Labour Party, a lot of youth with his anti-war message, with his populist message, this didn't change the fact that a lot of his colleagues in the parliamentary Labour Party are liberals, are Blairites, are to the right of him. They even tried to oust him in a coup, in a vote of no confidence in 2016. This vicious smear campaign by all of these actors is what contributed eventually to Labour's catastrophic loss a year ago in the 2019 elections. However, this witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, against the left wing of the Labour Party, didn't stop after the loss of the election. When Keir Starmer took over, who again is a Zionist without qualification, as he says, and a former prosecutor and former British intelligence, when he took over, he continued to persecute the left wing of the Labour Party. He appointed a bunch of Blairites to his cabinet, and he interfered in what was supposed to be an impartial investigation. Starmer suspended Jeremy Corbyn not even 24 hours after his comments about the EHRC report. Again, Corbyn acknowledged there was a problem with anti-Semitism. He just said that it was blown up by the media, which is factually true. Keir Starmer suspended him, and last week when the National Executive Committee reinstated Jeremy Corbyn,